Hawaii. With me is Mr. Nishimura. Mr. Nishimura represents Mr. Danielson, and I represent Mr. Wilson. We submitted joint briefs. Our cases are the same. The only difference is that Wilson was cited for the 924C count 6 and Danielson indictment with the same predicate robbery for the 924C count 7. And so there's no material distinction between the two. So with 10 minutes, we're not going to try to divide it up. So the case presents a couple of questions about the application of the categorical analysis to the predicate crime in a 924C case. So I think I would start by saying that our position is that the residual clause of 924C should be considered by this court to be a dead letter, given the precedent in Johnson and given this court's decision in DiMaia, and notwithstanding Beckles. In 924C, you have the residual clause. So the force clause is the issue. And the problem with, and this court has been doing what it calls categorical analysis for over 30 years. But the problem is that in doing the categorical analysis, in my view, the court has actually not ever really engaged with what is required. And it's true that over the years, the Supreme Court, as it's told us, this is what we always meant, seems to have been telling us, well, what you guys thought we always meant was never what we always meant. But we come down, and I think the important case, or one of the important cases, there's three really Supreme Court cases. Johnson won in 2010, Mathis, which establishes that in doing categorical analysis, what you're never supposed to do is look at the actual conduct, the actual circumstances of the case. And then the third case is Moncrief v. Holder, which says when you're doing it correctly, what you're doing is you're not examining the text of the statute, which is where I think this court has stopped previously. What you're supposed to examine is the minimal conduct that, based on case law or realistic possibility, would result in a conviction. And that's what has never been done. And so that's, in our view, where the court's precedents are incorrect. So if you look at bank robbery, what you have, putting aside the first part of the argument, the subsection D for bank robbery, strong arm bank robbery. So in bank robbery itself, all you have to have is intimidation. And over the years, intimidation has been defined in such a way.
In the House of Honor cases, so in this, by this court, they say that bank robbery or bank robbery is a crime of violence.
There's many such cases.
Does this court just lightly overlook those cases to go to the question that you are asking us to answer?
Yeah, I think the court needs to take stock of the fact that those cases have been undermined. And they've been undermined by Johnson Law, they've been undermined by Mathis, and they've really been undermined by Moncrief v. Holder. And the proper mode of analysis, I think, is suggested by this court's decision in Benally, where the court overruled a 30-year-old precedent on involuntary manslaughter being a crime of violence and acknowledged that, you know what, in light of the way this analysis has come down over three decades, it's not any longer a crime of violence. And the court then took its authority under Miller v. Gammey and said, when those precedents are undermined, a three-judge panel can recognize that, acknowledge it, and do something about it.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right about that. But so let's just focus on the intimidation element. So why doesn't, if that element has been satisfied, putting aside the subsection of the crime, doesn't that kind of have to carry with it an implicit threat that governments will be used if the victim resists?
One could think this court has concluded and say this is a robbery and carries an implicit threat. But the focus has always been on what is the reaction of the person who hears that statement or receives that note. Whereas the proper focus under categorical analysis is what was the defendant's purposeful conduct? Did the defendant purposely either use violent physical force per Mathis or threaten the use of violent physical force? And we know that that's not required because this court has told us in the Hopkins case that a politely, or at least a neutrally stated demand for money is is going to be enough to establish it.
But in that sense, in a situation, I'm not sure the purpose is necessarily required, but certainly knowledge that objective acts that the defendant is engaging in is going to cause this reaction in the victim, that is present in the Hopkins scenario, right? The person might have said it with a smile or said it in a polite tone of voice, but he knows that the effect on the hearer or on the young person who's on the other end of the recipient of that is going to perceive it as, I'm better to what this person is saying, or else, right? And that's sufficient.
But I don't think it is sufficient because it doesn't focus on the purposeful nature of the defendant. I think
so. What about the close of firearm?
Well, yeah, so for the arm bank or any part of substantial
use. Not just that. So that's what I want to be sure I'm saying, that you're making the clear distinction between where there is a firearm involved and where there's only a suggestion of someone that is.
There's a distinction to be made, but my position is that bank robbery is not categorically a crime of violence. An armed bank robbery under subsection G is not categorically a crime of violence. And we know that from the Martinez-Jimenez case, where this court held that the display of a toy gun is enough to establish that element. And so,
the intentional display. We have a case that says that the accidental display is not enough, right?
Inadvertent display.
Inadvertent, yeah.
Right, that's the
right case. But, so that's what I'm saying. I mean, if the defendant armed with something that looks like a real gun intentionally uses that as a means of intimidating the victim into complying, that certainly qualifies as a crime of violence. I don't know how you can. What more would you need?
What you need is a. So you could have a situation where a person walks into a bank, makes a neutral, non-threatening, by way of statement, as Hopkins, indication that the person's supposed to hand over money. And
is there this a neutral statement, hand over money?
I'm saying that
there's yourself in the teller's position. Somebody comes in and says, hand over money.
Well, what Hopkins said was the evidence showed that Hopkins spoke calmly, made no threats, and was clearly unarmed. So if you walk into a bank and speak calmly, make no threats. I mean, we have a case in our office where the defendant was actually apologetic. It's not this case. But he said, I'm sorry, it had to be you. And he handed over a note, and nobody, including us, had any problem with saying that under this court's precedence that constitutes bank robbery. The problem is that we have this whole line of cases which have required less and less proof in order to establish what bank robbery is, and you're guilty of it. And we have the other line of cases from the Supreme Court saying that the categorical analysis requires more than just the conviction.
But I'm turning back to Judge Sands' question. Let's put aside just the straight 213A, right? And then we're talking about armed bank robbery. I want to give you one more shot if your time runs out, because I have a hard time seeing how you could get on that. Maybe you're right. We don't run Virginia that says 213A by itself. It's a crime of violence. But how
can we not say that? The visible display of a firearm can't by itself be a threat. Otherwise, what are all these states with open carry laws doing?
I mean, why is not one of them? But 213D, if I remember, requires. Just want to look at the actual language.
It says, whoever in committing or an attempt to commit any offense decided to find a subsection A, assaults any person or puts in jeopardy the life of any person by the use of a dangerous weapon or device, shall be fined under this title.
That's what I'm saying. It's not just the display, and certainly not the inadvertent display, we know that. It's the
incessant. It's not the inadvertent display, but the simple display without any reference to it.
The more you need to say, if someone says, I'm here to get this money from you, and, you know, and I'm telling you, well, you don't need to say a whole lot, right, to convey an implicit threat that if you don't comply, this thing is going to be used against you. How else would one interpret that act by the defendant?
I would say that you have to take seriously what the Supreme Court has said and indicate that unless you can show that categorically the purposeful conduct of the defendant will always encompass what's required to develop. You don't have it as a categorical crime of violence. And I think that this, even under under subsection D, you don't have to have an actual dangerous weapon, but just something that appears to be.
Well, the ones that I was on the panel turned out when I had problems, you know, there with how we came out. But at least there, the Massachusetts statute requires the arm, but didn't require any visible display of it at all. These seem very different because it's requiring some active deployment of the weapon as a means of assaulting or intimidating the victim. And I guess
that's maybe the last point I'll make, Daniel, is I think the mistake that the court has made in the past, and it sounds like it's prepared to do again, is to focus on the effect of other people, whereas the categorical analysis requires a focus on the defendant's purposeful conduct, not on the effect of others. That's where the intimidation analysis is wrong, and it's also where the focus in subsection D is wrong, because it doesn't focus on the defendant's purposeful conduct. It focuses on the effect on other people.
Okay, we know that's wrong, because we have the case that says the inadvertent display by the defendant of the weapon, even if they're armed or they don't, is they didn't mean to use the weapon to convey the implicit threat. They're not guilty of this crime. And so that's how I know you're wrong on that point, because you cannot be convicted of the D crime unless you have done purposely knowingly, certainly, right?
Well, I would say that the Odom case definitely establishes one thing, that recklessness is not enough, because if you want to discuss what might be reckless conduct, it strikes me that walking in a bag with a gun in your waistband and inadvertently displaying it would be the very fundamental recklessness. So at least that part of it is out of the equation. So we're really back to my contention that it's purposeful conduct, and I think it's just not categorically here in every case. And if it's not in every case, then categorically the defense can't be a criminal offense.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, you have to do for rebuttal. Let's hear from the government here.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, John Taddy from the United States. As several of the Court's questions were getting towards, I'd like to address what this case is about. And it's about armed bank robbery, not the 2113A bank robbery statute, armed bank robbery. And what armed bank robbery requires, as the
Court just comes on clear, you have cases that is a 28-J letter citing cases from other circuits that dealt with just the 213A.
Yes, there are several cases that dealt with 213A.
Okay, but I just want to be clear, you're not asking us to decide this case just on this, and you want us to do that, just to do armed bank robbery.
No, Your Honor, a decision based on 213A, and the reason why we cited those cases is that would be sufficient to affirm the defendant's convictions and deny the defendant's 2255 motions, because if bank robbery qualifies, armed bank robbery with the additional element necessarily qualifies, but this Court can certainly write a more narrow opinion focusing solely on the element of 2113D.
But that's what I'm asking. Is that what then you start out by saying this case is just about armed bank robbery?
Yes.
So I'm trying to get a better sense of that. That's what you're asking us to do, is just limit our analysis to the 213.
Yes, Your Honor, that would be sufficient to affirm the district court's judgment in this case. And several of the panel's questions got to specifically Judge Saint's question about the fact that this is an additional element required on top of bank robbery. And this Court held in Odom that armed bank robbery requires the intentional display of the firearm. And as Your question got to what that communicates, and not solely on the receiving end of what an individual perceives behind the teller window, what a bank robber intentionally communicates by pulling out a gun during an armed bank robbery is one thing. You better hand over the money or else there will be violence. And that intentional communication of a threat is sufficient to meet the element of Section 924C3A requiring the threat or use of physical force. And as our 28-J letter and our briefs indicate, numerous courts throughout the country that have addressed this issue post-Johnson have reaffirmed that both 2113A bank robbery and armed bank robbery have a straightforward categorical matchup with the elements clause of 924C.
So this is six or seven circuits, agree?
Well, if you include Hobbs Act robbery cases and bank robbery cases, I believe at this point in published and unpublished decisions, it's 10 of 12 circuit courts in published decisions. I believe it's six published decisions since Johnson 2 have held that either Hobbs Act robbery or 2113A bank robbery or 2113A and D armed bank robbery qualify.
I think that's significant because we have held as a way we do our business, and we will not have conflicts with other circuits unless there's a substantial reason why we should do so. That is, we defer to a circuit, and you say we defer referring here to Sixth Circuit's?
Well, yes, Your Honor. In addition to that, this court's binding precedent under SELFA and Wright also holds that 2113A and D armed bank robbery qualifies as a crime of violence. My colleague cited the case of Miller v. Canny about intervening authority, potentially giving the court a basis to overturn binding precedent. And I have it right here. That requires intervening higher authority that's clearly irreconcilable with those prior cases. And two different panels of this court have relied on that decision to say that SELFA and Wright have certainly not been overruled. And those other circuit decisions also indicate that this court got it right and correct in SELFA and Wright in holding that bank robbery, armed bank robbery, qualifier to the elements clause. And that would obviate, of course, this court's need to address the constitutionality of Section 924C3B, which the government maintains is still constitutional, despite this court's opinion in Tamayo. Unless the court has any other questions, we would rest on our briefs.
Thank you, sir.
And our so for rebuttal tonight.
So I think the case that is important to resolve this, most important, is Johnson 1 and 22. Because what Johnson 1 said is that the force clause requires physical force and does not capture intellectual force or emotional force. So when you're talking about the effect on other people of seeing what appears to be a dangerous weapon or a firearm, when you're really talking about emotional or intellectual force, you're not talking about the purpose or use of violent physical force capable of causing physical injury that's required by Johnson 1. And I think that puts the proper context on this. In terms of your question, Judge Paulus, about what other circuits have done, the truth of the matter is no other circuit, as far as I can tell, has defined bank robbery down as much as the Ninth Circuit has. And let's recall, there's a reason why that happened. Every single case that said less and less is required to prove bank robbery had a smart young man that's just like Mr. Tete up there saying, for the government urging the court to do that, and they were urging the court to do that because what they want to do was uphold a conviction for bank robbery and avoid the lesser larceny, which is an included offense under the statute and has big consequences under the guidelines, particularly back when they were mandatory. So we're here with this crossroads between the court's prior precedent of bank robbery and what the categorical analysis required because the court was led here by the government. Now that it's time to pay the piper, as it were, they don't want to hear about it, and they want to tell you about other circuits where bank robbery is defined more restrictive than it is here. So I think that